Hello and welcome to Towards the Point, a cultural compass for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy, and in this programme, the last in our current run, we get smartened up and ready to strut for the Pompey club scene of the 60s and 80s. We consider how to make a scene, the good kind, and we get lost somewhere deep in the casino nebula by way of a tribute to Tangerine Dream. With me as ever is the Ubermeister of the electro set, the holder of the guest list that never stops giving, a man on the verge of a cultural revolution, it's Dave Allen.
Hi, James.
Hello, Dave. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And an interesting one, I think, this time, because we're going to delve into what we loosely call the club scene.
Yeah.
And we should probably start by kind of grading that for people, because what we're not going to do, I don't think, is play techno, start shouting and get out of our heads slightly.
I'm too old to do that these days.
You're never too old. You're never too old. But we're talking, I suppose, about how music clubs and small venues have played quite a defining part in the music that we listen to today and the kind of things we consume.
We might come to the conclusion, and I do say might, we might come to the conclusion that this was a far bigger thing way back, because we're going to go way back. We might decide that it's not at all. I think what we will find is that there's huge variety these days in what we think of as clubs. So if you go to somewhere like the Wedgwood Rooms, you're just as likely to get an alternative comedy night, and also a considerable mix of genres. You might get, you know, a woman singer-songwriter, acoustic singer-songwriter one night, and a kind of post-punk band the next, and so on. If we delve right back into the post-war club scene, which I suppose was always strongest in London, but then began to filter out into the provinces, certainly by the 60s, you've often got specific genres in specific clubs. I suppose the most famous of those in the whole of the country would be Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club in London, you know, which dates from the 50s. But certainly, in the case of the two clubs that we're going to focus on in Portsmouth, in tonight's programme, the first of those was heavily committed to a teenage subculture and a genre of music. That was in the 60s. And the second one, the genres began to open up a bit, but it was still definitively a music club. It was a place to hear live sounds.
So there's an element, really, of these clubs where it's kind of borrowed from jazz clubs and from folk clubs to an extent, but also a kind of cabaret element, really, you know, kind of a night out, a full entertainment, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a bit of all of those. I think jazz more than the sorts of clubs we're talking about, jazz more than anything. But the folk club point is a very good one. I mean, the folk clubs really were huge in Britain from the very late 50s and through the 60s, and that was certainly true of Portsmouth. And I think the other point that I haven't yet made is that perhaps clientele was different. So I'm being somewhat mysterious about the 60s, but the focus is on the Birdcage Club in Portsmouth, which began in Southsea and then had its own venue in Eastleigh. We've talked about it before, but it was the mod club, and it was the club where people went and, to a large extent, dressed in particular ways, that first wave of mods in the mid-60s. The club was open from 65 to 67. And musically, genre-wise, what it did was it hit that transition point from British post-jazz R&B into soul music. So you did get some great American soul singers like Wilson Pickett and Ike and Tina Turner and so on coming over and playing in the club. But you also got all those British club bands that were doing covers of soul music. Some of those had at least black American or black Jamaican singers. I'm thinking about Ronnie Jones, Herbie Goins, and particularly Jimmy James and the Vagabonds, who were hugely popular and were a kind of original British multicultural soul band with saxes and organs and so on. But sometimes you've got guitar-based bands, of whom the most famous would have been The Who and The Small Faces, who both played there, but also a band we're going to hear later, a very, very much a cult mod band called The Action. Those bands were rather more covering things like Tamla Motown stuff and so on. So they were sort of, they were, if you like, they were bridging that gap between the kind of blues-based stuff that came out of the Rolling Rolling Stones and the Yardbirds and the poppier stuff that the Beatles and the Beat groups were playing. They were somewhere in the middle because it was melodic and they used harmonies and so on.
And these were kind of these clubs, just to try and, you know, help me kind of get a sense of what they did. They were very much a place where that music was continual. Rather than, what I mean by that is today you very often get club nights, don't you? You get particular modes and particular venues, but these venues were kind of like consistent, you know, almost 7 day a week, you know, blues, whatever kind of music that they did.
That's absolutely right. The Birdcage didn't open ever on a Monday, but it would occasionally have special acts on a Tuesday, frequently Wednesdays, and certainly Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Sunday afternoon, people would just go and sit in the coffee bar and calm down over after the weekend. But it was almost entirely what we would now understand as that first wave of soul that slightly predates what we now call Northern Soul. A lot of Tamla Motown, a lot of Atlantic, a lot of Stax stuff. A lot of people like James Brown, and always at least one live band, sometimes a second live band that might have been a local group. There were some local groups that played there, Simon Jupiter in the Big Sound and St. Louis Checks and people like that. There was also a specialist DJ. There was a guy called Brady. His name was Pete Boardman from Cosham. His nickname was Brady from a TV show. And we're in Arundel Street now. He used to go just along from here in Arundel Street to Western Hearts Records, almost next door to what's now Debenhams. And he would get, I think, imports from America. So he would get some quite rare soul stuff coming before it got released in Britain. And you would go there and hear the latest, almost entirely black soul music that you could dance to. One of the interesting spin-offs of that is that on the first Saturday of every month in Portsmouth now, there is a club that plays that stuff. It's only a DJ's club. There's no live acts at all. It's the Dockyard Club in Onslow Road, Southsea, and I was there last Saturday night, and people danced the night away to classic 60s soul and classic Northern soul, which is a 70s phenomenon and slightly different. And that's one of the things that happened to clubs, of course, is that the live music scene began to fall away, and the clubs became much more places for DJs and dancing, which had a lot to do with the fact that simply that the top acts could command a fee that was way beyond the resources of clubs that would hold 400 people. You know, I mean, I've mentioned the Who and the Small Faces, but the Birdcage, there was also, there were acts with number ones like Georgie Fame and the Blue Flames and Chris Farlow and the Thunderbirds. The Cream played there with Eric Clapton. Early Pink Floyd played there in the days when it was beginning to shift towards psychedelia. Acts of that stature, you know, soon shifted into festivals and concerts, and so the live club scene struggled a bit for some time.
There was something also, I think, in, you know, reading around this, there's something to be said about what I would call the impresario. The kind of, there's some key figures and characters who make these things happen,
sure,
and who generate a scene. Nowadays, I think that's less so. Nowadays, you tend to have the promoter who does the marketing and the bookings and makes sure the venue won't burst into flames, those kind of different things. And it's much more left to the artist or the DJ to do some of the kind of creative scene setting. But in the 60s, very different.
Very different. There was, I mean, there was a huge character in Portsmouth at the time called Ricky Farr, who is for a long time now has been in America. His dad was a heavyweight boxing champion of Britain, I think that's right. Tommy Farr, his name was. His brother was the lead singer of an R&B band called the T-Bones, Gary Farr. Ricky Farr ended up running the Isle of Wight Festival. He's the guy who, if you ever watch clips of the Isle of Wight festivals, the famous ones that put on Bob Dylan, Jimi Hendrix, and so on. He's the guy that on occasions is ranting at the audience when the audience is getting very stroppy and demanding the fences been torn down and so on. But he was a larger-than-life character with... I mean, I think everybody knows he was a rogue in certain respects, but there's huge fondness for him. And he came from Brighton with a guy called Robin Best, who was much quieter, much more kind of self-possessed... classic kind of mod looking guy, really, and they discovered the potential in Portsmouth because of a different sort of club that existed prior to that called the Rendezvous. Now, the Rendezvous had opened in 1960 as a jazz club, a trad jazz club, and it was, in a sense, what you're suggesting. They would rent a room once a week, and they were the first Saturday night jazz club in Portsmouth. And the kind of Portsmouth beatnik scene would turn up, you know, in their duffel coats and corduroy trousers, and they would dance. Their dance was called the Stomp. But by 1964, Ernie Sears and his Oppo, I can't remember, who were much more kind of ordinary guys, really, who just liked running these clubs, they'd realised that the R&B thing was happening post Rolling Stones. They'd realised that that's where the scene was going, and they started booking Long John Baldry with Rod Stewart and the Animals and those sorts of people. And I think Ricky realised that there was this potential, but this was a club in an Oddfellows Hall up in North End. You know, this wasn't swinging anything, you know. And Ricky and Robin came down and they got hold of what's now the Casino in Osborne Road and opened the first Birdcage Club there.
And these things, I kind of guess, like most things do, like kind of trends, if you like, went through phases and gradually kind of fizzled out. And what I'm interested in is the kind of difference, if you like, between a kind of club setting and club scene to what we would commonly call now a gig, you know, a kind of small venue gig. What would you say were the kind of key differences?
Well, I think to a large extent it was driven by the young people who went there. I think it's worth remembering that they were young people. I mean, some of them were maybe about 18 or 19 by then, but probably almost nobody older than that. And I mean, when I went to the Birdcage for the first time in 1965, I was 15. And one of the things that was going on is that all the punters who went to the Birdcage, virtually all of them, would take an enormous care over what to wear, which was the whole mod scene. And I mean, I was a penniless schoolboy at the time, but anything I could do to make myself, you know, look acceptable, because I hid in the shadows in those days, but you could see that there were little scenes, and I think they were people who had been at school together or lived round the corner from each other in different bits of Portsmouth, or to a large extent the guys who were doing apprenticeships in the dockyard. There were a lot of them who were going together to the Birdcage and getting into that whole mod scene, which you can see a representation of in Quadrophenia, you know, and there are, you know, the Scooters, and they will still, you know, they will still tell you the stories about on a Sunday morning, you know, they'd go up to the Petticoat Lane market in London and they'd buy their leather coats, you know, and they, you know, if that you went with a mate and he bought a green one, you'd buy a black one or a blue one, you know, you wouldn't be exactly the same. And I do remember once going all the way to Brighton to buy a tie, you know. I mean, it's just kind of, you know, when I was getting about $5 a week pocket money, it's just crazy things, really.
Living like dangerously.
Yeah. There was no alcohol in the club. It was only coffee bar club. But there certainly were amphetamines. I mean, that was a part of it, you know.
Well, that's interesting. That's an interesting kind of change in the culture, if you like. Yeah. You know, I kind of alluded in the introduction to the fact that nowadays clubbing means a very different thing to people. It means, and I'm going to age myself already by saying this, but it means, you know, the small hours, kind of repetitive dance music, thumping sounds, if you like. Yeah. It means drink, all kinds of other youthful exuberance, all that kind of stuff. It isn't about the music or about the kind of focusing on the kind of richness of the venue. Mm. It's about going crazy in a warehouse.
I think there are both differences and similarities. I think in both cases the key element is young people wanting to have a good time on a Friday and a Saturday night. And I think it's also partly to do with differences in the way that young people live. I mean, it's worth remembering that I'm talking about the Birdcage where I was going as a grammar school boy, but most of the local grammar school boys at the school I was at, the vast majority of them didn't go. The mod scene was largely a working class scene, and it might be read in some respects as a scene that was hugely attractive to kids who could otherwise see a future stretching ahead of them of, you know, I don't know, marriage and kids. And
so it was a kind of rebellion, the kind of classic counterculture kind of thing.
Yeah, except different from the late 60s counterculture in that it wasn't politically motivated at all. It was quite, the mod scene was quite materialistic. It was about having things. It was about having scooters and decent clothes and smart living under difficult circumstances is the kind of key phrase to that, you know. Whereas later on with the counterculture, which that was more middle class. I mean, there was a different. There wasn't so much a club scene there as a festival and concert scene. You know, the people with their long Afghan coats and long hair and stuff, you know, who were then not taking pills probably, but if they were doing stuff, they might have been drinking beer or smoking dope. You know, they would go and sit on the floor of the concert hall at the Southbury Pier and, you know, and watch cool bands like Tangerine Dream, who we're going to talk about later. Yeah. But the dancing thing had gone. Dancing is a massive part of the mod scene, you know. So in that sense, funnily enough, the sort of early 90s clubbing scene does connect back to it. And I'm sure that there were people in that scene who were very discerning about which of the 12-inch things they were dancing to. But I think, you know, somebody like me goes and listens to it, I can't tell one from another. And I have been to a couple of those events with students. And I mean, you know, whereas I think if you listen to classic Tamla and Soul, they are melodic songs. They are coming out of a song tradition that is still quite powerful in the 50s and 60s.
We're going to talk later about where we think that kind of club scene is now and where it might go and where it's, you know, been challenged and what it's changed into. But you mentioned The Action earlier on, and they're a band that we've touched, I would say, in two or three programmes in the past. And they're a particular band that, you know, was kind of quite prevalent in the kind of, certainly in the Portsmouth scene. Just tell us a little bit about them and the track that we're going to play.
They were known as The Boys before that, and they were kind of pursuing a slightly pop agenda. But what they did was to hit on this possibility of doing, really particularly, doing covers of Tamla stuff, because they used harmony, vocal harmony. And in particular, covers of the girl groups. So we're going to hear probably their most famous track, which is a cover of The Marvelettes. Now, the Beatles had been covering The Marvelettes and one or two other people, but The Action just did it quite wonderfully well. The vocals were terrific. The whole instrumental thing drove along. The great tragedy of The Action was that they were one of the great cult live bands of that period. They were just one of the great mod bands, and there's a book out about them now, which was written by a Pompey mod, but it was released in London, and lots of London mods went and identified with it and so on. They were huge at the Birdcage. We just loved them to death, but they never broke through. You know, their albums and their singles weren't hits. They never broke through. And it's a kind of mystery to me why that was the case. And I think only one of them ever did. And that's the guitarist Bam King, who was in the 70s. He was in a band called Ace with Paul Carrack, who had a hit record with How Long. And that's about the only real success they ever had. But this is this track by The Action, I'll Keep Holding On, cover of Marvelettes, and it just sums up all that kind of energy and power that you got from those great live bands at the time for me.
We move now to Das Elektronika, and that is my very bad pronunciation in relation to the sad and untimely death of Edgar Froese, who was the lead protagonist in a band called Tangerine Dream. And if you're wondering what those strange noises are underneath our vocals on this programme, it's a track called Phaedra from Tangerine Dream's 1974 album, Phaedra. If you're listening to the podcast version of this programme, you won't be able to hear it, so you'll have to find it on YouTube. If you don't know anything about Tangerine Dream, well, you're in for a feast, really. They were really, I suppose, one of the early kind of champions of electronic music. And certainly Edgar Froese, who sadly died at the end of January 2015, was seen very much as a pioneer. Tangerine Dream themselves formed in 1967, but really I think they had their popularity and their hits, if we can call them that, in the mid to late 70s. That was their most successful period. Unbelievably, they made over 100 albums. Most of those were studio albums, although they became very popular live as a live act and very popular in Poland, which is a cultural factor I can't quite explain yet, or I can't get to the bottom of. Now, we'll talk a little bit about the music shortly, but Dave, the act itself and what we've been talking about and the theme for this programme, the kind of club scene, they're quite a difficult live band, I would suggest, early. They're not a traditional club band, are they?
Oh, not a traditional club band. And I think, in terms of what we were saying earlier, that what they were doing, really, was probably hitting the same age group, as the mod audience and other 60s people in the 1960s, who by this time had got into their mid-20s. I don't necessarily mean that all the mods got into Tangerine Dream. It might have been their peers who hadn't been mods, although I, for a brief period, I liked them quite a lot and did particularly like the track that is playing underneath us now. I bought that album, which I think came out on Virgin, which at the time was sort of cutting edge pop rock. It was the new kind of progressive period. They would have been played probably by Bob Harris and maybe even John Peel for a little while, I think, although I reckon Peel would have gone off them pretty quickly.
I think you're right. Phaedra in 1974 was the first record that they made for Virgin Records.
Okay.
And it went to number 15 in the UK album charts.
Yeah.
And it stayed there for 15 weeks, and it did so mainly through the radio play that it got through John Peel and some of the others you mentioned.
You've got to remember, you know, that if it was pitching itself, it would have partly, I think, pitched itself at a student audience, but also, you know, those guys who had been 16 in 1966, you know, they're now 24, and they may be at home relaxing in a variety of ways in an evening and putting albums on, and you know, this might be the album that you put on, you know, fairly shortly before you drift off to bed, you know. I did like it very much. The other thing to say about it is that it's part of that Northern European influx of musicians that comes, because through the 60s, really, what we were listening to was North American and British music.
Mm.
And then suddenly you do get, in the early 70s, you get Can and you get Faust and you get Noy and, you know, and Tangerine Dream. And they are... they're kind of less rhythm and blues rock and rolly, really, all of them, you know, and they're more steeped in other sorts of traditions, not least, you know, European experiments with electronic music in the classical field. So you've got Karlheinz Stockhausen, who's, you know, hugely important, Pierre Boulez in Earcam in Paris, and this is the sort of pop age of that as well. So it's pop becoming intellectual.
I think the word experimental is key about this. Mm. I listen to, and I have been for the last week or so, listening to various Tangerine Dream tracks, and it just sends me in a strange kind of mental state, really. You know, it's always wrong, I think, to kind of pigeonhole music or bands or acts, as it were, in particular brackets. But it's kind of, you're right, I suppose its root was in kind of psychedelia.
Yeah.
And I think Edgar Froese, when he started out, was very much into making his own instruments and recording the kind of environment around him or noises in his everyday life. So that's the kind of, I suppose, the start, really, of what you might call ambient music now.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It links to some of the soundtrack work that they did. But there's a particular tag, a particular phrase that they've been given, and perhaps, I don't know, perhaps they gave birth to this kind of kraut rock idea, you know, and that's a very British term, which in really links to electronica, which again is another kind of British term, another classification, which we arrive at really because we don't understand the music or we can't relate it to things.
Yeah, I think the genre thing is complex there, because in fact Can and Einstein Neubarton, who, you know, get on stage with pneumatic drills and smash stage, you know, I mean, that's very different kind of stuff from...
we should play them underneath this, maybe.
Yeah, we should. But I think you use the term ambient, and I think that's quite a key one. A lot of this, in some senses, it seems to me, has its roots in a band that I mentioned at the Birdcage, who played the Birdcage in 67 and astonished everybody at the time. We'd not really seen or heard anything like it, and that was Pink Floyd. Now, I think some of these other bands actually are more accomplished musically probably than the Floyd eventually, and they kind of take it further. But another British musician who's very important in the development of ambient music, of course, and about the same time, is Brian Eno. And Eno's music at that time is just beginning to emerge, those kind of ambient soundscapes. And if you hear something, I mean, there's one in particular that intrigues me. I do listen to it sometimes. It's called Neroli by Brian Eno. And if you listen to that and then listen to Phaedra, which is still, you know, drifting on beneath us, you know, you compare Phaedra to Neroli. Phaedra is like the ABBA of ambient music in comparison. You know, Neroli almost doesn't exist. You know, he's almost removed everything from it. And I mean, it's interesting, you know, if one pursues the intellectual thing, which I don't think we should do too much, but you can see parallels in the other arts. You can certainly see it in minimalism, in the visual arts, where people suddenly, you know, start producing, you know, a white canvas, you know, and stuff like that. So there is that kind of impetus to it.
There's a really, I think there's an interesting kind of statement about technology in their music. You know, what I've kind of learnt to date about their music. And I think it's twofold. One is, it's very clear that they're trying to project an image of the future. Right. So something that's said about Phaedra a lot is it's described as it's what a voyage to another planet would sound like. Right. You know, so there's that idea of kind of space travel and a kind of ethereal, unknown, futuristic side. The other, some more practical, technical side, if you like, is that Tangerine Dream are one of the first bands, if you like, to start using the synthesizer and sequencing kind of as an instrument, and the Moog synthesizer in particular, and the kind of, you know, the Moog, a particular manufactured keyboard, if you like, came on the scene at this time, and they were quite brave in using it almost to the max. You know, it's often said about Phaedra and some of the other tracks on that album that you can hear the valves and the circuits fading in and out as they kind of cool and warm, you know, those kind of things. So that's a really interesting kind of statement about where they think we might be.
Two sorts of technological things there, aren't there? I mean, there was a shift in the... I think you can see the roots of that, particularly in a very innovative British record producer of the early 60s, and that's Joe Meek, who is the kind of antithesis of the back-to-roots blues and folk thing that's going on. So that, you know, that goes back there. But you're right about the technology, and I mean, it was also manifest in the late 60s in the sort of second phase of the Moody Blues and other people who were using synthesizers to sound like other things. The sci-fi thing is fascinating because, again, you can see parallels in other cultural things. And science fiction in the 1960s, for example, was quite popular on television in this country with Doctor Who, but not necessarily elsewhere at that time, and the American Star Trek. But there's not a lot of great science fiction cinema in the 60s. And then suddenly, towards the late 60s, you get 2001, Arthur C. Clarke. And people, I can remember that kind of first phase of the hippies, people actually buying that soundtrack and listening to that soundtrack. And that was another kind of late night, slightly spaced out experience that, you know, you'd play a Pink Floyd album, then you'd play 2001 soundtrack. So that context is set. And then in the 1970s, there's a kind of explosion of science fiction. You get Charlton Heston making 7 science fiction films a year. And, you know, a lot of it quite dystopian.
It's interesting you mentioned 2001, A Space Odyssey. Yeah. Because there was some controversy at the time about the soundtrack of that film. Because there are two versions, there's about 3 or 4 versions of that film, but there's a good chunk of silence at the beginning and the end of those films. And apparently in the US there was a huge backlash because audiences just couldn't cope with the silence. Yeah. You know, they had to just cope with the image. So, you know, there's an interesting relationship there. It brings us on to, quite nicely, I think, the kind of soundtrack element of Tangerine Dream's work, because they were very much about the story, about the narrative. And I think they only made 2 albums that actually had vocals. So there's actually only singing on 2 of their albums. And bear in mind what I said earlier, they made over 100 albums. So, you know, it's a great afternoon in, I think, at least.
I did go and see them live at Chichester Festival Theatre, which was always seemed to me the perfect... You know, you wouldn't want to go to a sweaty club like a 60s club, you know, where you might see The Who or somebody. It seemed to me the perfect kind of genteel venue, but I don't remember any vocals on that particular occasion.
Yeah. They did the soundtrack to the film Legend, if you can remember that, all those years ago, which is kind of, a fantasy kind of Dungeons & Dragons style film, to Risky Business as well. They did the theme tune we're going to hear later on. We're going to hear a theme tune they did for a popular TV show in the 80s called Street Hawk, okay? I said this to Dave earlier and he looked at me blankly. Hopefully people listening will know what Street Hawk is. If you know what Knight Rider is, virtually the same, except it's a motorbike. If you don't know what Knight Rider is, I think you need to get on Wikipedia and educate yourself. But more recently, and this is another kind of tangent of technology, I think, in relation to their music, they did the music for Grand Theft Auto V, the video game. Now, that's a whole genre of things we've not even thought about or touched on, but very much they were kind of trying, I think, as an outfit, as a band, to experiment with new things and to try new space and new places. Now, I bet you a number of people, a number of gamers, if you like, don't even recognise that it's them playing. But that's taken to a whole new audience, really. We're quite experimental. I don't think we've talked about many bands or acts that do video game soundtracks.
No, I'm not aware of any, but then I don't know anything about video games. I mean, I think a part of what might well happen, I don't mean this too cynically either, is that people might well come to a band like that and say, how about this? And the band will see the dollar signs flash and say, yeah, okay, we can do that, and get on and do it. I mean, if early days, Floyd were doing soundtracks, weren't they? They did More, for instance, which was a pretty strange kind of European film, but they did the soundtrack to that. And I think it's almost inevitable that kind of slightly floaty, synthesizer-y type, you know, with occasionally with bits of beats in them and so on, it's almost inevitable that it lends itself to soundtracks. And I, funnily enough, I used to be quite excited about it, but these days I've got pretty tired of watching drama on television that has that same inevitable soundtrack stuff on it all the time, and usually loud enough that people of my age can't hear the dialogue any longer, you know. And I long for some kind of stripped back realism, really. But I'm not surprised to hear that story.
I like the term floaty there, particular. If you have just tuned in, you're listening to Towards the Point with me, James Sandy, and Dave Allen. And in the background is the title track from the 1974 album Phaedra by Tangerine Dream. And we're trying to mark, really, the passing of their frontman, Edgar Froese, who sadly died last month. And he had a great quote as well, a great quote that was re-quoted after his death. He said, "There is no death, there is just a change of our cosmic address." I thought, that's great, isn't it? You know, what a great kind of final sentence.
I think that's them to a T.
Final sentence to have. I mentioned Street Hawk earlier, and it would be very wrong of me not to play that track. So, Dave, this is going to be a cultural experience for you. This is a track which is actually called Le Parc and appears on their 1985 album of the same name. And see how faster and more progressive it gets. You are listening to Towards the Point with me, James Sandy, and Dave Allen. And in this show, we've gone clubbing. We've talked about the 60s club scene. We've touched on Tangerine Dream and their 70s electronic craziness. And we're moving now, Dave, into the 80s.
We are. And there's a reason for this. I didn't really make enough of it, perhaps, that at the end of February, as this show is going out, is the 50th anniversary of the Birdcage Club opening in the 60s. Well, back in January, it was the 30th anniversary of another club opening in Portsmouth called Basins. And Basins was actually opened by two guys, Chris Abbott and Jim Lawrence, who were both Birdcage boys. Their initial idea, they opened it down in Southsea in Palmerston Road, and they did what we were talking about earlier. They rented one night in another club, which was predominantly a disco club called Someplace Else Club, which is no longer in existence.
That's a great title, isn't it?
It was a really kind of, it was one of those quite elaborate, quite posh, you know, lots of lights everywhere and all the rest of it. But their notion was that they were going to open a club for the former Birdcage clientele who'd grown up into clubbers who would go out and see the kind of pub rock R&B blues bands that were around, particularly in London at places like the Dublin Castle and so on. And there were some really red-hot bands there, some really good bands on that scene, and they thought that they'd make a go of that in Pompey. And I had the privilege of being in the first band that ever played there, which was rather lovely. We were the local support act, because it was an R&B band called the Reds, and we supported Wolfie Witcher's Brew, who were down from London. But after a few weeks, Chris and Jim realised that actually that clientele wasn't going to turn out on a Tuesday night in that way, so a number of changes happened. First of all, they moved, this is an interesting link, they moved round the corner to Osborne Road and inhabited the same building that the Birdcage Club had opened in, which in itself was rather nicely nostalgic. And
there must be some kind of magic stone in that part of the ground.
I think it's ley lines, mate.
Oh, okay.
To go back to Tangerine Dream, one of the bands that they put on there that was a kind of link between the old R&B scene and the punkier stuff of the 70s, and I think it's worth saying that clubbing with live music came back to life in the late 70s, maybe entirely because of tracks like Phaedra, you know, around the punk scene. You know, I mean, punk really gave everything a kick up the backside, and it was terrific, and loved it. And So one of their favourite bands at that time was the Wilco Johnson band. Wilco had come out of Dr. Feelgood, and he had bass player and rhythm section, I think, out of Ian Jury's Brockheads, and they were terrific. And the club began to pick up, not only with the visiting acts, but with one or two very, very fine local bands as well. What happened eventually was that they found out that there was the opportunity to purchase Granny's Nightclub, which was at the top of the Tricorne.
Another great name for a club.
Why would you call it? I don't know.
Good for a tea shop.
Yeah, but they did anyway. They bought it, and I think towards the end of 1986, they moved up to the Tricorne and had a couple of fine years there. The most famous of the local bands that played at Basin's in its third incarnation at the Tricorne was Empty Fish. And Empty Fish had with them a bunch of guys who danced very stylishly called the Shaking Sharks. That was just great fun. I mean, but what was fascinating about it was that there was clearly a kind of youthful clientele that went there, which was sort of post-punk. A lot of the what's known as the 657 crew, the Pompey Hooligans, they used to go up there and occasionally have get a bit too lively, shall we say, particularly around Empty Fish. But what was interesting was the mix of music. So there were lots of acts turning up there who some had played the Birdcage. Gino Washington played there. Steve Marriott of the Small Faces played there. But also much newer acts. So, I mean, Bad Manners or the Guana Bats, who were a kind of rockabilly punk act of the time. Pop Will Eat Itself. That Petrol Emotion, I can't probably tell you as much about some of those as you can tell me. There was a big ska thing up there. Some of the old Jamaican ska guys like Laurel Aitken, who was up there with the Potato Five, and Desmond Decker, who was big ska name. He came up there. Some punk act, the sort of 999 people like that, and My Bloody Valentine, so there was a real mix of acts and extraordinarily lively. I did see, for a club that got about 300 people in it, I saw probably the biggest fight I've ever seen in a Pompey club there. There was a good one on Southsea Seafront when The Who did a special Birdcage night at the Savoy Ballroom, and there was a pretty good fight that night in 1965. But there was a quite remarkable one with Brendan Croker and the 5 o'clock Shadows, who were a quite modest, quite moderate kind of little bluesy, rootsy act, not the sort that you'd expect. But it all kicked off.
It's always the ones you least expect.
Yeah.
So in the 80s, in terms of Basin's, there's a focus again on music scene, isn't there?
Yeah.
And kind of the club venue as a starting place, but also a kind of launch pad and a kind of a place where people can go to taste and test new music.
And I'll tell you what else was the case, that in a sense, the 60s and early 70s, at 60s up to the mid-70s, you've got that shift from Teddy Boys to rockers to mods to casuals to skinheads to punks. The subculture thing had kind of exploded, really, where people might be into subcultures and they might not. There was a mod revival in the late 70s, but that's a rather different thing. And so by the 80s, if you look at the photographs of the crowd there, you've got all kinds of different people. You've got for a start, you've got different ages. It's no longer just teenagers. There were people like me going up there, and I was by then mid-30s. You've got people, some people who look kind of rock and roll-y, and some people who look like punks, and some people who still look a bit like skinheads or casuals or whatever. You've got that mix, and you've got the mix of genres as well. So there's no longer that kind of obsessive adherence to one kind of thing, or the fear of turning up at the Birdcage with a slick back greasy hair and a leather jacket. You wouldn't dare, really. I think there was a mix which is, I think, even more prevalent today. I mean, I think those things they haven't vanished, because there are still mod cults and punk cults and so on, but they kind of seem to live alongside each other in a more peaceful way these days.
Now, like most cultural phenomena, it's impossible, really, to pick out all of the kind of separate ingredients and the things that make the club work, but also create a scene. Now, I was racking my brains while we were, kind of preparing for the show, and I thought, David Byrne has written a very good book called How Music Works. It is a very, very good book. I would recommend it to anyone who's got an interest in music, who plays music, or even just listens to music. There's a chapter in his book, chapter 8, in fact, where he outlines a number of things that a club needs to make a scene or a successful scene. He bases this on his, I suppose, his own personal experiences of playing Talking Heads and other bands from the New York scene. So a club called the CBGB Club, which is quite a famous club. The first thing he says is there must be a venue that is appropriate size and location in which to present new material. So he's talking about the scale and the environment, which is an interesting fact. Secondly, the artists should be allowed to play their own material. No covers of Tangerine Dream, so that isn't allowed. They must have the space to do their own thing. Performing musicians, this is controversial, this one, must get in for free on their nights off. And maybe, he says, get free beer too. Impossible, I would say, to identify who the musician is and who the chancer is in terms of protecting your revenues. Mm. He also suggests that there must be a sense of alienation from the prevailing music scene. So there's a kind of a sense there that it's a space, a magnet for the outsiders, which is another interesting point. He goes on, and there's a number of these, to some practical things. I like David Byrne, he's a very practical person. He says rent must be low and it must stay low. So the success of the club shouldn't impact on the artists in any way. They should be the benefactors. They should be the people gaining, not just financially, but gaining from the popularity, which is an interesting one. Bands also must be paid fairly, and there must be what he calls social transparency. It must be encouraged. It must be a venue that's open to all. Even if it only attracts a certain niche or a certain cohort, it must be open to everybody. Running through them very quickly, I think there's just a couple more. It must be possible to ignore the band when necessary. So the space must allow for people to go to the bar, get a shandy or whatever they want, and think, oh, the band are playing in the background. So those are the kind of main 8 principles that he goes through in the book. Great book. Have a look at that. We'll put a link to it on the blog. But Dave, I'm interested. You haven't read the book. We've mentioned it a few times, but what do you think about his advice?
Yeah, I've got some thoughts about the size. The interesting thing about the Birdcage and Basins is that both of them were about the same size, probably 300 or 400 punters maximum, I would have thought. And I think there is some kind of quality to that. He doesn't talk about the entrepreneur, the people that the personality and the people that run it. But I think that in the case of Ricky Farr at the Birdcage and Chris and Jim, but probably particularly Chris Abbott at Basins, their personalities were really quite powerful in making those work. And in some clubs, that's true. It's not necessarily always true. Sometimes in the London clubs, it was the DJs who did it. The thing about alienation and bands having to play their own material and so on, I mean, I think bands can be quite inventive without necessarily having to write. So I don't know. The other problem about alienation, about this sort of opposition to mainstream music, is what happens when the alternative becomes the mainstream? Chuck them out.
When the revolution becomes the establishment,
Paid well, I absolutely agree with.
And the free beer, no doubt.
I mean, actually, I have to say that even as a local musician at Basins, and I did play at all three venues, we were tremendously well looked after. My relatively brief experiences of touring in a professional mode with bigger name people and so on is that all sorts of stuff happens there. There are riders and stuff where you do actually turn up and get fed and watered quite nicely and looked after, and people will, if necessary, actually book you into B&Bs or hotels or something as well. So I agree with all of that, but I think what he's talking about there is a New York scene about letting bands in, where everybody knew everybody and it was a very vibrant scene and so on. And I guess there have been times when it's been like that in Portsmouth. The most obvious time when it was like that in Portsmouth from my lifetime was in the 60s, was a different club entirely called the Indigo Vat, which used to cater mainly for local bands. I don't remember that we ever got in free, even though we might have played there, but you were kind of welcome and recognised as a local musician if you went to those clubs. So socially open one is interesting, because the Birdcage would never have worked had it been socially open and welcoming. It was a mod club. They didn't want people turning up who weren't hip. I mean, you just couldn't have it. It just wouldn't do. If you hadn't thought long and hard about what shoes you were wearing that night, you know, don't come in. So, you know, that's a very antisocial attitude. But that's, I suppose, in a sense, you know, what I'm talking about there is that classic working class, clean living under difficult circumstances thing, you know.
Well, let's jump forward now to where we are in the modern idiom, as they may call it. Now, I'm not going to pretend that I have great knowledge of what's known as the club scene. Now, you know, hedonism is still something I have to look up in the dictionary, so there's a problem there for me. But there is something, I think, in terms of how music's consumed and experienced, where, you know, things like Spotify and music streaming services have given people instant access to taste and get a flavour of bands. But also we have the smaller gig venue flourishing, but we also have this notion of the in-store performance, you know, linked to... Yeah. The promotion of a record, or you know, to the sale of a particular release.
I went to that Christmas event that Pine Vinyl ran, and I think Pine Vinyl is probably at the hub of a certain kind of little scene. I reckon these guys are 30 somethings, I think, and a lot of the guys in particular got beards. I didn't think many of the women did, but I liked everything about that scene. I thought that was rather nice, but it's not a regular scene. It's not like the Birdcage or Basin's open three nights a week and happening every, you know. So I think you're right that all of that's diversified. I was also reflecting last night, we're recording this a little before, and last night I caught a little bit of the BAFTAs. There was this huge crowd that turned up to see the Film Stars, and Film Stars have always been big, but I think they've come back and become bigger, and I think musicians are less important than they used to be. I think there were periods in the 60s, in the late 70s around punk, and certainly that period in Basin's when the musicians themselves were hugely important. In the 90s clubbing scene, music became important, as it did in Northern Soul, but it wasn't the musicians, it was the music, it was the records. I don't think it is as important these days. I think it's diversified. I think you go out and have a good night. You can go to the Wedgwood Rooms and have a good night, but you probably don't go three nights a week to check out what people are wearing and all the rest of, you know. I'm not sure that people in Portsmouth actually go up to London on a Saturday, go round the shops, check out, you know, a new pair of trousers, a new jacket, get back to the club that night and impress everybody with the club and do the dancing. I don't think that happens, and it really did happen. There's no mythology about that. The hippest people in Portsmouth in back then really did do that. It was thrilling, really. And it was partly that you had to go searching. You couldn't get stuff online, you know. You had to go searching for those rare records, those rare trousers, those particular ties that you're going to wear, whatever it might be. You had to make an effort to get there. And somehow it seemed worth doing. Was it better? Goodness knows. I suspect that if you're 18, this is the best time to be alive. Whatever, you know. But I shall be eternally grateful that I grew up in the period that I did and lived through those particular periods and had a kind of second go around the 80s with things like Basin's. That was rather lovely. Yeah.
Well, let's have another slice of music, which isn't necessarily from the 80s, but links to an act that you mentioned.
It links to both of the stories that I've told, really, because the vocal is by Roger Daltrey, who with The Who performed, I think, four times at the Birdcage Club and, of course, was very popular with 60s mods. But he's singing with the guitarist that I spoke about, who really was very popular at Basin's in the 80s, and that's Wilco Johnson, you know, who was in Dr. Feelgood in the 70s, worked with Ian Dury, and then since then has had his own band. And for some time recently, we thought that he was terminally ill and was doing his last gigs, but they did some extraordinary operation on him, and he seems to have recovered. And about a year ago, he released a new album with Roger Daltrey on vocals, and I just thought, well, it ties up Basin's and Birdcage very nicely, celebrate the two anniversaries. It's high energy, typical Wilco kind of thing, you know, R&B roots. And
let's have a bit of that. It's called I Keep It to Myself.
All right, all right, all right, all right. Sounds good. Let's put this together.
Well, just before we go, we've just got time to catch up on some events and releases to keep you going for the next couple of months. Coming out very soon in March, in fact on the 6th of March, is a new box set of Who singles, in keeping with some of the things that we've been talking about. The Brunswick singles set from 65 to 66, 7-inch box set. It's going to cost you a whopping $49.99, Dave, so you better start saving now. There's some fantastic things in there, beautifully put together.
That's my favourite Who period, I have to say. I've got two events, really, and they're at the Eastney Cellars, which is one of those venues in Portsmouth of that kind of size that is doing its best to preserve live music and all sorts of good stuff. On the 27th of February, this coming Friday, Bill Kirchen, who's a great kind of country-influenced rock and roll-y, not rock, but rock and roll-y player. I've seen him there before, and he's terrific, really good value. And then later on into March, the 20th of March, the crazy Arthur Brown, Arthur Brown of The Crazy World of Arthur Brown, who has an extraordinary voice and is probably worth seeing because he's very entertaining, and I saw him a few years back, and I reckon he's worth checking out as well.
If you're around on the 9th of March, you can catch Cara Dillon at the Wedgwood Rooms, and tickets for that are £16.50. Doors open at 8 o'clock, and you can find more details and information at www.wedgwoodrooms.co.uk. If you were after catching Paul Weller, the Mod Father himself, he is sold out at the Portsmouth Guildhall. He's playing the 9th of March. But don't be disappointed, you can catch the Stranglers a week later, Monday the 16th of March, or their March on Tour. Very clever, that. You can catch them playing at the Portsmouth Guildhall. Check out their website for more details there. That's it for this series. You can catch our archive of shows through our blog, towardsthepoint.blogspot.co.uk. My thanks, as ever, to Dave Allen for his wisdom and guidance throughout. Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.